All right, good afternoon, everyone. It is 3 o'clock, Tuesday, February 2nd, and we're looking at the Chem12BL lab this afternoon. And we're gonna have a shorter lab session this afternoon because I'm gonna turn you loose to go do some stuff on your own for some of the recordings that I put up online last night. And what I thought I would do was talk a little bit about the lab, my idea for the lab, how I expect it's going to run, and the schedule that it's going to run on, and due dates and things like that. So, and the other thing that I was going to do today was go through the separation scheme a little bit to give you a better idea of where everything is breaking down, because there was a lot of questions as I was going through my lab notebook and talking to students this morning about the lab notebook. The idea of the separation scheme came up, and you guys had never really done one of those before. And so showing you what a separation scheme is, how it works, how you make one, giving you sort of that overview idea. So let's start in the same place that I started with this morning. Let's start by a screen share and showing you the Canvas shell and the way that I've designed this exercise to work, okay? So let me jump into second desktop. And so what I've got here is just the lab Canvas shell open, and you're seeing the instructor view. So you're seeing some things that you may not see within your Canvas shell, but down below, the molecular modeling one is not live. You won't see this. You'll only see the Grignard one that is set up. And the Grignard has an introduction, a preparation of a laboratory notebook, the pre-lab lecture. This is the lecture that we had last week. So this part you've already done. There are now videos that are up live. The post-lab lecture, which will happen next class on Thursday. And then some resources for helping you to write the formal report after we go through and do all of that. And each one of these has information inside. So when we go to the module on the Grignard, the instructions are here. The reaction is written out for you, just to give you a graphic and image to show you what this is. We're working on a six millimole scale. We'll talk more about how reactions are scaled, what scale means, and how reactions are sort of put together. We'll do that on Thursday. But basically all the parts were to review the experiment in the book, mainly to help you be able to prepare your laboratory notebook. This is the work that you would do normally before coming into lab so that you were prepared to be able to do the lab. I still kind of want you to do that because I think even after watching the videos, as much detail as I put into the videos, I'm worried that they have, I don't know, they're kind of entertaining and you may not get as much out of them, of the actual chemistry, as you would if you go through and do that preparation first and get your lab notebook all set up. So that's that first part. Then we did the pre-lab lecture. The pre-lab lecture was really to explain the chemistry and the context of the experiment, and to give you an idea the best I can without actually being in the lab and seeing what's taking place in the lab. Then I went in and I made these videos. So I did this Friday and Saturday. I spent 2 full days there, 16 hours of filming. And then I did like 12 hours, 14 hours of post-production work to put these together. So there are 3 videos right now. There will be 4, hopefully, after tomorrow. And the fourth one is the analysis part of going in and taking the melting points, taking the IR, showing you how to do those things. We'll have one more Zoom meeting that we'll do together on the 4th, that's on Thursday, where we'll talk about the data workup and really spend more time talking about how do I want you to treat this lab material, the data that you got, what sort of workup am I looking for, and what things do I want you to think about that will go into the write-up. So that's going to be that lecture. And then the last part is the actual instructions for the write-up. And those instructions are mostly up at chemed.study, and I linked to them within Canvas. So everything is linked from Canvas. You can do everything you need to do from within the Canvas shell. But all the files mostly reside over at chemed.study, and you can get to them over there if you want to. If you'd rather just go in that route, that's fine too. So let me show you and talk about the laboratory notebook for a minute, because this is the biggest thing, because you guys haven't been in a lab really, and you didn't do any real lab work with Zaruba. I think Zaruba had a couple of labs that he had you do, but they were mostly virtual. They were sort of him explaining the lab, I think, in most regards. And you didn't really use a lab notebook, and you didn't do any lab write-ups. So first thing is, I have a detailed rubric that explains the laboratory notebook. And it's a pretty big rubric. So it goes through the categories that I think of for the lab notebook, which is the overall organization of the lab notebook itself. The heading, which is the informational part that describes a lab and its purpose for doing the lab. So that heading is the title, the purpose, the procedure. It includes a chemical reaction, if that's appropriate, such as the Grignard reaction has one that's appropriate. And then there's a data section and how you handle and write out that data and keeping it organized and accurate and not obliterating anything. And then there's a whole legal component. And I think I explained my reason for the legal component of my experiences in grad school and how I want to teach the right way to do things and how to handle a laboratory notebook. So the legal component here tells you under mastery, the way I read these rubrics is mastery is what you should be doing. If you are in the accomplished category and you're making a few mistakes, you're still doing great. If you're in the adequate category, you're running sort of middle C in the adequate category, D developing is sort of the D category, and beginning is it's not working. You're not pulling here. So I usually just read the mastery category and maybe the accomplished to see where some of the errors can start cropping into things. But this tells you basically what you should be doing. And then the legal component, which is the hard component, understanding what that looks like. That comes from this article, which is an article that was written by a patent law firm called Darby and Darby. And it's an old article, it's from the 90s, but it still serves as what you should do in a written laboratory notebook. This is a patent law firm, and their whole thing was dealing with patents and intellectual property. And the laboratory notebook, it used to be more important in the United States was a little backwards. And it was extremely important in the United States that you kept a laboratory notebook in a legal format because, number one, we didn't have digital records. And the United States was first to invent, not first to file. What that means is that everywhere else in the world, when you filed for a patent, if you were granted that patent, the patent was yours and nobody could ever take it away from you because you were the first one to file for that patent. But the United States, the law was written such that it was not the first to file, but the first to invent. Meaning that if Company A in 2000 went in and filed for a patent and was granted that patent, and then in 2001, Company B sees that Company A got to that patent first and snuck it, and yet Company A had been working on that technology for 10 years, they could take their laboratory notebooks into a court of law and take the patent away from Company A, even though they filed first, just because it was their intellectual property first. That's how important. So these were worth millions, if not billions of dollars, just this little black book right here, and in keeping it in a legal format. So what Darby outline are the following guidelines for which all laboratory notebooks should be maintained. And the biggest thing here is that you don't want to create questions you don't want somebody to be able to ask, why did you obliterate something? Why is something missing out of the notebook? Why is there a hole in the notebook? Why is the notebook not dated? Those are all the questions that it seeks to prevent. So the biggest thing, the biggest difference between what I teach and probably what everybody else teaches is that most people teach that the laboratory notebook should be experiment-based, meaning that all the consecutive pages have one experiment, and then you don't start the next experiment until you're finished with the first. And so it goes experiment by experiment on every page consecutively. But that's not how this is meant to work. This is meant to be more like a diary. So if you think about a diary, you wrote in your diary based on the day that you wrote it, and you didn't leave blank pages to come back and write in your diary at a later time. You would just go to the next page, and that was a chronological record of your time, of what you were doing and how you were feeling and what you were thinking on that day. That's what this journal is. It is a chronological record of what you do in the lab, not a record of the actual labs themselves. So every single page should be written on in chronological order, regardless of what lab you're working on, which means that sometimes you're bouncing back and forth between two labs as you go through the journal. That's okay. There are fields that are on the pages that are designed to deal with that. They're called to and from pages. And so if you start an experiment, and I know you can't see what I'm doing, so I'm gonna stop the share for a second and make my screen bigger. So there are pages in here that when you're looking at the pages, at the top of the right-hand page, it says to, or no, it says from, I'm sorry. And down at the bottom left, it says to. So when a page is constructed, you can tell the preceding page that goes to this experiment. It may be two or three pages back, or 10 pages back, or 15 pages back that experiment left off. And this is where you are now coming back to it and entering data after a long period of something being in an oven or recrystallizing or something that took a couple of days. You come back to it after those couple of days, and I'm coming back from page 15 and now I'm on page 27, something like that. And then I may leave this and come back to it at a later time. And so the two down here tells me what page do I go to in order to be able to track that experiment through time in the journal. That's all it's designed to do. But there should not be any empty pages in the journal in between experiments, because an empty page leaves questions open. It leaves open, why is there an empty page? Was there something that was taped in the book that fell out? Is there pieces of data that are missing? Those are the types of questions that we seek to avoid. And that's why we never leave empty pages in the notebook. The notebook is technically supposed to be hardbound, meaning not that it's a hard cover, but that the pages are not meant to be torn out. There's no perforations in the pages. That way pages cannot be removed. And the pages should be inked in, numbered, so that you can tell if a page is missing or if something has been doctored in a book. So those are the parts that make up a laboratory notebook. And then every single page needs to be signed by you as it's completed and should be dated and ideally witnessed. Now we're gonna skip the witnessing part because you have nobody to witness your laboratory notebook. So we're gonna ignore that part. But when you complete writing on a page, you should sign the bottom of the page and you should date it, saying that that page is now complete and will no longer be modified, except perhaps for the to and the from fields. And that's it. Okay, and so. So
does that mean that later notes would have to go on a different page?
That's correct. Later notes would go on a different page. Absolutely, because it's a chronological record, not an experiment-based record. And all the other things that Darby and Darby have here are things that tell us how to avoid other errors. For instance, you should only write in black ink. You should not use abbreviations, code names, or product codes without defining them clearly. Doesn't say don't use them, just says that they should be defined someplace. Usually I like to pick one of the index pages in the beginning and make that my page where I put my abbreviations, and then I'm free to use those abbreviations throughout the book. So you can use abbreviations, you can make abbreviations for certain chemical names and use them throughout the book, but they should be defined somewhere in the beginning. With a caveat, I shouldn't need a secret decoder ring to read your laboratory notebook. So if you're going to make abbreviations, use them sparingly and for the things that are really a pain in the butt to write over and over again, something that is really long. Those types of things, you can create abbreviations. Never
are
erase.
Abbreviations are common abbreviations of chemicals like ET for ethyl, okay?
Yes, and those don't have to be defined. So ET for ethyl or ETOH for ethanol or ET2O for diethyl ether or any of those common solvent abbreviations that somebody who is knowledgeable in the art is the catchphrase. That's what we call it. That means somebody who's been a practicing chemist for a period of years would be able to look at that and read it and know exactly what it means because it's a common abbreviation used throughout the field.
And then just to clarify, the from would be just the last page that was written on, or would it be the beginning of the experiment?
If you were starting a brand new experiment, then the from gets crossed out, meaning this is the start of an experiment and there is no place that this is coming from. This is the first page. If you are picking up an experiment after several days and there are pages in between, the from goes back to the last page on which this experiment took place. So it may not be the first day the experiment was written on, but it would be the last page from which the experiment had in the book, if that makes sense. Okay. We never erase.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Ashley.
A question about the lab notebook. Last lab session, you said that we can use, like, if we have like the rest of a lab notebook or something.
Yes.
I have this one from Kim 1B.
Perfect.
Like 70 pages left.
Use it.
Okay. It says it starts on page 35, but.
Perfect.
Okay, cool.
Just start on page 35. That's the way it goes.
Okay, thank you.
Don't spend any more money. That's exactly what we're going to do. Okay. All right, so erasing, no erasing. Just draw a line through the error. Let me show you. I have question, Garrett. I guess you can't have a laboratory notebook on my iPad. Garrett, ideally it's supposed to be a record where it cannot be deleted or changed or modified. I'm going to go with some flexibility here in that in writing on your iPad like that, if you have an iPad, it's incredibly easy to output the iPad into PDFs in order to get them to me. I'm fine with that. Let's make things a little bit easier here on everybody. All right. So if that's part of your workflow right now, I know it is for mine. I'm doing everything on my iPad. Then I'm going to be okay with that. So
yeah, yes. ever since March, I haven't touched a pencil basically or a notebook. And so I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, that's fine. That'll work. I'm going to be okay with that too. I still feel like if I don't give you some of this information, I'm not doing my job. So even if you're doing electronically, I want you to have at least heard this in how things are supposed to be done. And so one of the things that I did in going in and doing the experiments and why I went in on 2 days, on Friday and Saturday, in order to do the experiment that we did. This is rather embarrassing, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway. I went in on Friday to do the entire experiment and I skipped the trituration step and I went right to the recrystallization step. Completely crushed my entire experiment because I was going to have to go back and refilm it and it was going to mess up all my data and I couldn't do it. I just crossed off that page. So that page, notice that I didn't line out everything. I just put a diagonal line through the entire page so it can still be read so you can still understand what it was that was done. And then on Saturday, I went back in and I did it all over. So when you make a mistake, don't obliterate it. Don't cross it out, strike it out numbers of times and color it all in and don't try to hide it or make it so that you can't see it. That then leads to questions about what was so bad that you needed to hide it? Why did you have to obliterate it? So those are things. So it's all about avoiding questions. Never tear out or remove a page. Each page should be signed with the inventor's full name and dated. No entry should be changed or added after the signature is applied. Each page should be witnessed. And if an additional entry is made between the initial and final pages recording an experiment, the entry should identify the page on which the previous entry from that experiment occurs. That is our to and from fields. That's what number 9 is. And then step 10 here is when you're done with the laboratory notebook and you work for a company, the laboratory notebook is the property of the company and it stays at the company. It never goes home with the scientist. Taking a laboratory notebook home from the company is grounds for dismissal, for being fired. These are kept on the premises always. They're kept in a fireproof safe. They are the intellectual property of the company and they are worth millions or billions of dollars to the company. So they're protected at the company. Those are the important things. And then they have down here, these are things just to avoid that make the record less meaningful. Illegible entries are totally worthless. Unsigned, undated pages are almost totally worthless because they could have been created at any time. Notebook pages, which have been witnessed, are almost as bad as unsigned because you don't have a corroborator to say this was done on the date that it was actually done. A long delay between the signing of a page by the inventor and the witness raises questions. Consecutive notebook pages, which are not dated in chronological order, raise questions. So like I said, every page should be chronological order. Missing notebook pages raise questions. Erasures and deletions raise questions. All of the legal component of a laboratory notebook is about avoiding all of those types of questions. And that's what my rubric takes into play. So when you go and you look at the rubric, that's the legal component that is here. That when you read it, it just says all pages consecutively numbered and entries dated, black ink used exclusively, abbreviations clearly defined, no blank pages between entries, portions of pages left blank intentionally struck zero, zero obliterations of data, completed pages signed and timely witnessed. Boom, done.
I have a question.
Go.
Does the witness not have to sign anything either? Because how would you know if it's witnessed or not? I don't know.
In a laboratory setting, usually you are working underneath a lab manager or somebody who witnesses your work for the company. They're familiar with your work and they're verifying and they're saying, yes, this was done on this date. In this format, we can't do that. So in this format, we're not going to worry about that. We're just going to let go of the witness signatures right now.
Okay, so there would be witness signatures.
There would be, if we were in a lab setting, then I would be witnessing your laboratory notebooks up to a point. And then after, and I use that mainly so that I can give you immediate feedback. At the end of the day, you hand me your laboratory notebook and I witness it and I sign it and I date it. And then I tell you, hey, here's some things that you could do to improve as you're doing it. At about the middle of the semester, or maybe like 4 weeks into the semester, I get tired of signing everybody's and having a huge line of everybody wanting me to sign their notebook. So what I say is, hey, everybody, I'm done. I'm not signing another notebook. You guys get each other to witness your notebooks. And then I look to make sure that you're getting people to witness it and that it's witnessed in a timely way. And we treat it that way. So we just kind of open it up to anybody witnessing it in that regard. Okay. All right, so that's the laboratory notebook part. And as I said, I have these organization heading, data and legal. And when I'm doing my laboratory notebook, let me stop the share again. I know that this is probably not an optimal mode to show you this, but I'll try. My laboratory notebook, this is one that I was using for computational experiments. And I'll show you that here was the start of an experiment for my computational ones. And what I have up here is I have the title that I've given it. I have the reaction that I'm trying to do. I actually have a purpose that I've written out on why I'm doing this computational experiment and what it is I'm trying to achieve. For me, the procedure was computational. And so I'm writing down things that I'm changing in the computation that I'm trying to achieve. So that is my procedure in essence. I have some of my file format structure, things that are very important to me that I'm changing. And then I have my data that actually comes out of this and my job name and where it's stored and located. And so these were going to be for publication later. Not that I published my lab notebook, but I was trying to keep good records because my computational work was for publication. Okay. Switch over to our Grignard experiment and I do the exact same thing. Here's the title of our Grignard experiment. the actual chemical reaction that's taking place. I have a purpose that I've written out. My purpose for this Grignard experiment was simply introduction to organometallic reactions and more sensitive organic laboratory techniques. So it's just taking everything that you learned first semester and putting it all into one experiment. That's basically what the purpose of this Grignard experiment is. And then the procedure oftentimes is a condensed form of what is in the laboratory manual. You want to be able to work independently of the laboratory manual. You want to be able to visualize what it is you're going to do in the lab. And that means the same thing you would do in your kitchen when you're cooking. When you're cooking, if you're trying to cook from a recipe book where they have all the text in there and all the things that they're telling you, that's really hard to cook and read from that book at the same time. So what you do is you make a bulleted list of all the steps that need to happen and the measurements that need to be taken. And that becomes what you actually follow for your recipe. Lab is exactly the same way. It's exactly the same thing. And sometimes I'll include images of what it is that I'm going to be building or doing in order to accomplish that within my procedure. My procedure is actually fairly lengthy and then breaks up where my workup starts and what I'm going to be doing in my workup. And then when I'm done with all of that, so that's all that part. Oftentimes what I include then, before I even start the experiment, is what's called a separation scheme. A separation scheme outlines where everything goes in the chemical reaction as you're going through the workup. Where, as you split things up into different containers, where does each chemical or byproduct or product that I'm after go, and in which layer is it so that I can keep track? This is a skill that I have to teach you how to do yet, how to write out separation schemes. But basically, they start where you first separate two things and put them into two different containers. So when you're doing an experiment, most of the time what you're doing is you're taking and you're combining things to make the experiment run. But at some point you start disassembling and taking it all apart. Separation scheme starts at the first point of separation. And it ends when you get down to your final product. And that's all that remains is that final product. We'll look at how to do that. And then of course I have my data section. And my data section has all the measurements that I'm going to take, and it may have some observations as well that come into play there in the data section. And after the data section, I don't have this yet because I haven't sat down and written it out yet, would be my conclusions and some of my calculations just to show what actually happened in that experiment. So that's kind of what I'm looking for. Now, laboratory notebooks don't have to be beautiful. Laboratory notebooks are a work in progress. And so laboring over them to make them perfect and the anxiety over somebody looking at it, you don't generally have anxiety over your diary or what your diary looks like because you have no expectation that anybody's ever going to read that diary. It's just for you and it's your freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and all the things that you want to put in it. Laboratory notebook is kind of a cross between the two. It's for you. And it's for keeping track of your experiments and it needs to work for you. And so don't get anxiety over it being in any particular style or any particular state of disorder or order. I mean, ideally we want it to be structured and have some structure in it, but if your handwriting is messy and that's just kind of the way you write, then that's the way it's going to be. It needs to be legible, it needs to be readable, but it doesn't have to be beautiful. So it's not graded on how beautiful it is, it's graded on how functional it is. That's what we're looking for. So don't get anxiety and twist it up over the laboratory notebook. All right, that is all of that part. Let me then take you over to the pre-lab lecture. We already had this. This is archived and you can go and watch it again, but you guys already sat through this lecture. So this is where we talked about the Grignard and the organometallic reaction that we're going to be doing, how that reaction works. And I even showed you some of the glassware and ran through how that experiment was going to be set up. Now we've got the lab videos. So the lab videos are linked under the lab lectures. And I have them linked right here. So you can get to them right in Canvas. But if you wanted to, they're also at chemed.study. And they're just sitting under here under, I'm not even screen sharing. You don't even see what I'm doing. Lame, Jason. Okay, there we go. They're right here under chemed.study. And they tell you how long each video is. So you have an idea of what your commitment time is as you're going into that. Let me get back to here. And I have them linked in the Canvas shell as well with the time commitments of knowing what they are. I got a little crazy with these videos. I've been dying not doing lab. Lab is one of my favorite things. It's partly probably why I teach organic chemistry is because of how much I enjoy lab and teaching these lab skills. And somehow I got into the vlogging mode. And so this is organic chemistry vlogging at its best. And I put some music into it and some Easter eggs into it here and there. And I don't know, we'll see. I got a little crazy. We'll see if it's sustainable. I don't know how sustainable this is gonna be. So you guys can watch it. And I'm actually pretty interested in your feedback as to, you know, you can't go into lab and I can't teach you how I do all these things. And so this is basically exactly what I would teach you if we were in lab and how to do each little skill set. That's what it is. So watch these, have your laboratory notebook ready because there's data. I usually queue it up and tell you, hey, next time I'll meet you over at the balance and we'll get the tear weight or the measurement on this. So you know when a measurement is coming and you know what it is that we're going to be measuring. It's pretty clearly defined. And then Thursday, we'll have another Zoom lecture. This will be the post-lab lecture where we actually talk about what occurred, the data analysis, what it is we're looking for, how well the experiment went. We'll talk about the IR and what we're looking for in the IR scans. We'll talk about the melting points and the different things that could have happened in the melting points. All of that stuff we'll discuss on Thursday after you have viewed the videos. So make sure you watch those videos before Thursday so that you have an idea when we're talking what it is that we and what we're going to discuss. And you may have questions after watching the videos. This is the place to get those questions answered. And then after that, we've got the Green Tube formal report. So writing a formal report, there are formal report guidelines that are up online. These formal report guidelines were written between me and the Chem 1B instructor at the time, Christy Vogel. This is before Albie took over Chem 1B. And Christy and I sort of agreed on an outline for formal reports so that the curriculum was consistent. And we changed it a little bit for organic and Chem 1B. Because there's different focuses in Chem 1B, you're about numbers and you are about percent difference with an expected value. But within organic chemistry, there is no expected value. And so besides maybe a melting point. And so the way that we talk about data is different in organic chemistry than it is from within Chem 1B. And this goes through all the different parts, the overall document and what the formatting for that document should be, the title, the abstract, the introduction, what should be included, the last paragraph of an introduction, which should be a non-technical overview, the methods and materials section, for which I give examples of what methods and materials look like for those written sections, the results section and what should be in there, the discussion and conclusion section, the language and formatting that you use and how you express things, how you draw or present figures, charts, schemes, or tables, the differences in how those things are done, and how you keep your references, and an example of those references written out in their proper way. So all of those things are included in here that tell you exactly what you need to do for a formal report. And then along with that, I've got the formal report rubric that shows you what I'm going to be looking at. All my rubrics are this exact same style. They all have the exact same categories and values placed on those categories. It's just how many subcategories do I break that down into that I'm looking for the point basis. So I rate it based on its abstract, the introductions, methods, materials, results, discussion, conclusion, and then the overall language, grammar, and formatting of the formal report. And then, because I know you guys haven't written a formal report before for Zaruba, I threw in an example formal report from a former student, not for the Grignard, but for the Aspirin Lab from first semester, so that you can get an idea of what a pretty good formal report looks like. So this was Nicole. Nicole has since gone on to graduate school and is doing great. And this was one of her formal reports for that Aspirin Lab. And just, she did a pretty good job. It's not perfect, but it gives you a good idea of what it is that I'm kind of looking for. And these things here, the drawings, these I generally say you can do by hand. Don't spend your time trying to find a drawing program that is going to make nice, beautiful graphics. Just draw something by hand, snap a picture of it, and insert it in as a photo and do it that way, as opposed to trying, because trying to find a drawing application that does this is not fun or easy, and it's expensive. And then there's a whole learning curve, and you could spend hours trying to do this when what I want you to do is spend hours on the writing part in the text and the understanding part, not the drawing part. Okay. That is then due in 2 weeks. So I've set a due date on it on February 16th. And if we need to, if we find that we need some flexibility in that, we'll deal with it when we get it there. The formal report I would like in a single PDF if possible. There are several cell phone and iPad scanning applications that work across Mac and Android and PC tools. The one that I like the best is TurboScan, but there are many others. You can use whatever one you like to use. Scan each of the pages so that they are in a contiguous PDF, and then label it last name, first name, Grignard.pdf, and there will be an upload button over here on the student version where you can just upload that PDF when you're done with it.
Is the lab notebook, how do you talk English? Is the lab notebook a part of this submission?
Normally what I do, yes, is you have the report itself for which, oh, I should have left it on the screen share. I was gonna show you, Nicole had her separation scheme as the last pages in there. Usually what students will do is take and they will photocopy their lab notebook to give me in person. However, in this format, yes, if we could do a PDF of it, if you could snap the, use the scanning application on your cell phone or tablet, and then include it as some of the pages that go in with this at the end of the document, yes, that would be appreciated. Okay. Have I laid this out clearly enough?
So, I have a question.
Yes.
Prior to adjust it. So when, before we start watching the lab videos, are we supposed to have like our lab notebooks like set up a certain way, or like the purpose, or will we be writing that stuff as we go?
I would write up the purpose and do all of those things beforehand. However, there's two ways to do this. You can watch the videos for entertainment level, and you can get an idea of what it is that you're going to do. And you could then make notes of where weighings are occurring in each video, sort of like a time frame of where that is. And then you could just go back to that time frame when the weighing takes place with your laboratory notebook after it's set up to get those measurements is one way to do it. So you don't have to watch things multiple times. Or you can set up your lab notebook totally ahead of time and just have it sitting there with you while you're watching the video. And then you can take down the data as we're going through and doing that. Either way.
And we should already kind of know like what are the sections within the lab book besides like the purpose, the data information. I don't know.
Yeah, your sections within the lab notebook are really just that heading section that is a title, the experiment that's being undergone in terms of a formula, and then a purpose, and then a procedure. The procedure can be taken from the laboratory manual in just writing down what that procedure looks like, I also gave you a pretty good detail of that procedure in the lab lecture, the pre-lab lecture that we did. So you could alternatively rewatch that pre-lab lecture to write down the procedure from. Although it's probably going to be easier to just take it out of Pavia rather than trying to extract it from a video. After the procedure, then either, and this is a strong suggestion, you have a data table of reagents. A data table of reagents lists each reagent that's going to be used in the lab, say like diethyl ether, isopropyl alcohol, bromobenzene, magnesium metal, and it lists their physical properties, their melting points, their densities, so that their molar masses, so that you have all that data that you're going to need to work up the experiment right there concisely in front of you, and you've done all that work already. And then I have my data section where I'm actually taking all my data. And then at the end, you will oftentimes have a small conclusion, but not a great big written up thing at the end, because that write-up is the formal report write-up that you're actually doing. You're just processing some of your data and saying, you know, you do some of your calculations in your laboratory notebook, and this is my percent yield that I got on this. And you may have like a spectrum that you get from the IR that gets printed out and gets taped into your laboratory notebook in certain pages so that all the data is all consecutively in there in place. And that's it. That's what goes in it. Okay.
And then we attach that like PDF of our notebook to the report.
Correct.
So we have like two PDFs, or should we attach to the one?
Well, you can, there, if you want to submit two PDFs and do it that way, we can do it. I think it allows you to submit multiple files.
Okay.
So you can submit multiple pages. And if you run into any issues with it, you can always just send it to me as an email too.
Okay. Okay.
And I'll figure it out somehow.
Okay. Cool.
We'll make it work.
To clarify, it would be best for us to watch the videos first, and then so that we can already like know like how you did it, and then go to the lab lecture.
The process that I sort of envision is using the lab manual to be able to get the procedure out of, to write out your laboratory notebook and know what data is going to be taken down based on the procedure that's there. Then I would go and I would watch those three videos that I have up and the fourth one that's coming that is going to be on the analysis of the product that we get. And I would take down the data that's in those videos in your laboratory notebook while you're watching it. That's what I envision. Okay.
Were we gonna talk about the separation?
Oh yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
That's a good idea. All right, separation schemes. In a separation scheme, their purpose is to understand the workup. To know or track where everything is going. And the purpose of each step. When doing a lab, it's really easy to just do the lab and follow the directions and never really know why you're doing any particular thing. It's just, I need to do A, B, C, D. And I guess there's two types of cooks, you know, if you cook at all. There's those people that just don't cook at all. But there's two types of cooks. There's cooks that follow a recipe and they do something because the recipe says to do it. And then there are cooks who look at a recipe and decide to kind of go their own direction. And they use it as a foundation for something and say, oh, I see what they're doing here. I'm going to do this. If all you know how to do is follow the recipe, you can never sort of invent your own things or have fun making your own things because you don't understand the actual reasons why we do certain things. The lab is exactly the same. If you understand why you're doing each step, you can question bad steps and decide to go a different track to do something that makes more sense if you actually understand why it is that you're doing each thing. This is the power of what a separation scheme does for us. So they start at the first point of separation. Our first point of separation is where we take the material and add in the 6 molar hydrochloric acid. This is the first time that we take the reaction and split it into different containers in the workup. And the idea is that we want to list all of the things that were in the reaction before the separation, and then where they go after the separation. So what you have is you have your starting materials. Let's say instead of, we'll just make it more concise, reactants. You have your products, your solvents, and then maybe byproducts that you're tracking that you know that you need to get rid of. So in our reactants, we took bromobenzene. We reacted that with magnesium metal. We made phenylmagnesium bromide. And we reacted that with benzophenone. And I like to do them by structure more than I like to do them by name because that helps me to figure out where things are actually going. Because we're going to use their structure and polarities and properties to figure out kind of where they go. The product that we made at this step before we acidified was the alkoxide ion 4, which the magnesium and the bromide were counter ions. Our solvents or solvent was diethyl ether, and two byproducts that were possible were benzene. That was made from this guy reacting with water. So the Grignard reacting with water could make benzene. And then one other byproduct is called biphenyl. And biphenyl is made from the reaction of the starting materials. These two materials together make biphenyl. So the Grignard can react in what is called an SNAR, substitution nucleophilic aromatic, an SNAR reaction, which forms that biphenyl. So this is everything that was in the chemical reaction. And then when I add 6 molar HCl to it, the reaction goes biphasic and I separate it out in the separatory funnel. So this step is the separatory funnel step. And it actually didn't create two layers, it created three. We had a gas, we had an aqueous, and we had an organic. The gas that comes out was from the magnesium metal reacting with HCl to produce hydrogen gas. And so we saw that liberated as bubbles coming out of the round bottom flask in the separatory funnel before we did the extraction. The aqueous component is the water, the HCl, a little bit of diethyl ether gets pulled into the water, the magnesium salts, and the bromide. So all of those things are getting pulled into the aqueous phase. And in the organic phase, we have everything else. We have the diethyl ether, some water finds its way into the diethyl ether, and then all these other organic molecules. So I'm going to start back here a little bit. Now we have to be careful because some of these organic molecules don't, the organometallics hydrolyze in the 6-molar hydrochloric acid. And so I don't have that Grignard anymore. If there was any Grignard that was left over, it got converted into benzene when I added the 6-molar hydrochloric acid. And the phenyl magnesium or the triphenyl methoxide magnesium bromide gets converted into triphenyl methanol.
Could you pause for like just a second? I'm just trying to write it all down.
Yeah.
Could you also explain, Jason, why there are things that have been separated but are on both sides of the...
Yes. I think you're thinking about why do I get diethyl ether over here and over here? Why do I get water here and over here?
Right.
That happens because of diethyl ether's ability to hydrogen bond with water.
Mm-hmm.
And the hydrogen bonding with the water means that some water gets pulled into the diethyl ether layer and some diethyl ether gets pulled into the aqueous layer.
Okay.
And so they wind up going both directions. So that's about the compatible nature of diethyl ether and water, even though they're not miscible with each other. Not being miscible does not mean that they don't have some small solubility or appreciable solubility. There's benzene that is over here and biphenyl. And those are the two last things that are in there. So after that first HCl step, that's where everything goes. Now, these things here, these are going to go into waste. And we're going to track and we're looking for this guy over here, the triphenyl methanol. That's what we're going to keep working with. And so this organic stage, normally what we would do is we would normally do our next separation this way and just track this limb of it. But what I find myself needing to do is to work sort of in a more linear fashion, because I find that if I were to do it like a true tree diagram, I'd be way off on the side of the paper and it never seems to work out quite as nicely. So I always move it over just a little bit. Okay. The next thing that we do is we add in the saturated sodium chloride solution. This was a pre-drying step, and it makes an aqueous layer and an organic layer. And in this step, we get the same things again. We're getting water, diethyl ether, we get the sodium chloride, that all goes in the aqueous. And the organic is really unchanged, except for what I would say is we have less water. It's not dry yet, but we've got less water. And then all the organics go back in. So this step pulls out large amounts of water as a pre-drying step, but doesn't get it totally dry.
If there's a step where the one of your separations don't change, can you just can you denote that in some way instead of redrawing all of these pretty little things?
You know what I tend to do sometimes is I'll create abbreviations. Like I'll say that this guy here, instead of redrawing everything, is PH3COH.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe what I say here is that this thing is it's not in the C group, so I can't do an AC. I don't know. We can make some abbreviations for some of these to make it a little bit easier to draw them out in the separation scheme, as opposed to having to write out the big structures. But for right now, for me doing it, for you seeing it, I think it's easier to track where everything is going if you can actually see and understand the structures.
What isn't that, wasn't completely dried in this step?
It was not completely dried in this step.
So what, notice, what's the it?
Notice I have less water. So I had water up here. Now I've just got less water.
The it is the organic layer, Maria.
Yeah, the ORG is the organic layer. This AQ, that's the aqueous layer. From this step, we go and we do a drying step with magnesium sulfate. Magnesium sulfate is a hygroscopic material. It's anhydrous to start with, and it makes a solid when it's mixed with water. And then I get a liquid. So now I'm not tracking organic and aqueous. Now I'm tracking different states of matter, solid and liquid. The magnesium makes magnesium sulfate heptahydrate. And so I get that heptahydrate that is a solid that comes out. And now the liquid is diethyl ether, but there's no more water in it. So now I have all the organic materials, but no water present. And you're right, it does just take time to draw these. And they're so firmly embedded in my brain that I don't even really need to think while I'm drawing them.
Is the organic layer usually less dense?
It is, yes. The aqueous layer, density 1.0 generally, and the organic layers are usually around 0.7. So they generally reside on the top. That is true, that in a separatory funnel, that what we typically see is that the organic is here with a density equal to 0.7. And the aqueous is here with a density which is usually equal to 1.0. However, that can flip. You have to be careful. CH2Cl2, a very common solvent, has a density of about 1.4, I think. And so if you're using methylene chloride for your extraction, then the methylene chloride will be on the bottom layer and the water will be on the top layer. So you have to be careful of certain solvents that have higher densities. Usually those are your halogenated solvents though. Anything that is not halogenated is usually closer to 0.7. All right, once we get rid of the water, the next step is to rotavap. So I use this symbol for heat. It's a capital delta. In physics, we use it for change. In chemistry, we oftentimes use it for change, but in organic chemistry, you use it for heat. And this symbolizes the rotavap and evaporation. So here we're using boiling points and evaporation in order to separate chemicals, and we will get a gas and a solid. The gas is the low boiling diethyl ether, and the solid are the other five constituents. After we do this step, we generally do the trituration step. The trituration step works by, how much room do I have? Yeah, we can fit it in here. The trituration step works on polarities and uses petroleum ether. The petroleum ether, being nonpolar, is a mixture of C5 through C7 isomers with a boiling point around 34 to 37 degrees Celsius as a boiling point mixture. So there's no single compound that I can draw. And what we get is we get a liquid and we get a solid. The liquid has the petroleum ether. And it also has all of the fairly nonpolar components. These are all of the components that do not do hydrogen bonding. So that's all of those guys. And then the solid, hopefully, is pretty pure already. And what I normally do, if we're going to do a recrystallization step, is that I'll include the word in there, impurities, meaning that there's some trace contaminants that I'm going to get out in my last step, utilizing the recrystallization to get out those last trace impurities. I may not know what they are, or I may know what they are. They're a combination of all of these, but it's a way of just grouping them in together and not having to write them all over again, because they're just small amounts of all the organic stuff that was in there. And the last step is recrystallization. So in this step, we use isopropanol, or you could list it out as 2-propanol. This is the recrystallization step. And in this step, we end up with a liquid and a solid. And in the liquid, we have isopropanol and those impurities. And in the solid, the triphenylmethanol. And so the separation scheme, starting all the way from the top, you get sort of an idea, an image there of everything that we do. This breaks out every single step and where all the chemicals go. And it helps to understand the steps, but it also helps to understand where the waste goes. For instance, this material here, isopropyl alcohol, that would go into organic waste. Petroleum ether with all these organics, organic waste. Diethyl ether, organic waste. Magnesium sulfate, which is a solid, would go into solid waste. The aqueous layer that is here, aqueous goes in aqueous waste. And so it breaks out your waste streams as well, makes it really easy to identify where everything goes in a waste sense.
Are you putting your waste always on the right, or did that just work out this way?
Just worked out that way. I think in practice, I do it in my mind, and I've just always done it that way, but it certainly does not have to be done that way. There's no right or wrong is the answer to that, Mary. So that's a separation scheme, and separation schemes can be very simple for an experiment that maybe just has a single recrystallization at its end, or they can be fairly complicated, like this one where there's a fairly lengthy workup and it just takes a little bit of time to be able to get through all of these different parts that are in here and everything in between. But they start at the first point of separation, and they start with everything that comes out of the reaction and everything that you put into the reaction. And then you start divvying it up as you go through. And if you are doing a reaction for the first time, and it's a reaction you've never done before, and you're trying to figure out, how am I going to work up this reaction? Your job then is to think about all the things that could have come out of the reaction. And after knowing sort of what you expect to come out and what you put in it in terms of all the solvents and everything, to design steps that will separate it out efficiently. And that's just done on a step-by-step basis until you can get it down to that final thing. And that's how people actually just design new reactions and new workups. How do we decide what workup we're going to do? We sit down and we figure it out. That's what we do. Does that give you a better idea how that works? Or at least what this separation scheme looks like? It takes practice. These take a lot of practice. None of these things, I should say this too, I oftentimes feel empathetic when I'm looking at your faces and seeing there's no way in hell I can do this. This is crazy. Who does this? Nobody does this. If you were to sit down at a musical instrument that you've never touched before, say a clarinet or something, you'd have no idea how to play it. And even if you were taking your first lessons, you would sound horrible. That's just the way it is. And it's not until months of practice, maybe even years of practice, that you start to get better at it. I've played guitar since I was a teenager. I still suck at it. I'm horrible at playing guitar. That's just the way it goes sometimes. But I get better when I practice. And these skill sets just take some practice. That's all it is. This is a skill set like any other. And I do not have the expectation that you can do this after just watching a video like this. The expectation is that we will give you times to practice this and be able to learn it. Okay. All right. What else do I need to tell you? I think I've sort of given you everything. I think it's time to sort of send you on your way to go watch a video or two or three and watch me do some silly things in the lab. I threw some music in there too, to keep you entertained. I don't know how successful that's gonna be. But anyway, it's an attempt. It's a work in progress. You guys can give me feedback and I can change it up if I need to. So let me know what's working, what's not working, what's helpful, what's not helpful. Okay.
I have one question. In the manual, is it just experiment 33A or is it?
Great question. I sent out an email earlier that some people have earlier or later versions of the manual, and the 33A is a rough guide. That was in version 5 of the book that it was 33A?
Yeah, version 5.
Yeah. So, yeah, it could be 35. Look for triphenyl methanol in the book. If you look in the index for the book and you see triphenyl methanol, that's the experiment that we're doing. It's in every version of the book. They've never thrown it out. It just may move chapter to chapter or experiment to experiment.
Benzoic acid's not part of it. There's like.
Correct. It is not part of it.
There's like multiple like parts or something.
Right. So correct. Okay. The Grignard reaction can go one of two directions in the book. The same reagent is used to make either benzoic acid or triphenyl methanol.
Okay.
And it just depends upon what substrate you want to react the Grignard that you make with. We choose to make the triphenyl methanol. And so it's just part A that we do.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, anything else come up? I'm gonna stop the screen share. See how we're doing. Because I think that's all the info I've got for you. So I think it's a matter of just watching those videos now and getting a better idea of what that lab looks like and getting the data down for that lab, okay?
Is there a separate Canvas class for the lab?
Dylan, there is indeed. There are two Canvas shells because they are two separate classes. So the shell for the lab is 12BL and the shell for the lecture is 12B.
Okay, I think I might not be added to the lab one then because I had to go through to the email to find this link.
Well, the interesting thing is, why are you not added to the lab? Because if you don't have the Canvas shell,
like favorite it, like you have to go in on Canvas and like favorite it.
Okay,
that could be.
Well, check your web advisor first and make sure you're enrolled, and then if you are, yeah, sometimes you need to allow your thumbnails to be seen.
Thank you, Mary. Yes, I think that I had checked the enrollments and I was not aware of anybody who was in lecture who was not also in lab. Dylan, your name doesn't ring a bell as flagging as a problem for me. So, but check WebAdvisor, make sure you are enrolled in the lab, and then go back into Canvas and see if you can't find the Canvas shell for the 12BL lab.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, let me know if there's a problem. And if there is, then I can start working some magic on my end to get you into the lab if you need it. Okay, I think that's it.
Thank you.
All right, I'm gonna let you guys go. I'll stay online if there's any questions, but I'm gonna go ahead and stop the recording.